don't be fooling around. I tell the truth. Nothing's secret. Secret.
Devil search for the secrets to immortality. I alter my physical chemistry. Bop through the valley of the shadow of death. I exist even when no things are left. Vibrations transcend space and time. Pure at heart because I deal with the mind. That's why I compose these verses. Lord of all worlds, my thoughts are now universes. Written on these pages is the ageless wisdom of the sages. Ignorance is contagious. So I hope you keep your focus. There's no hocus pocus. In the end, it's just us. Devil got brother killing brother. It's insane. Going out like Abel and Cain. Wisen up and use your brain. There'll be no limit to the things that you can gain. In positivity, balance it with negativity. Until then, ain't the devil happy. Ain't the devil happy. Happy, so we'll wear my hair nappy. Naughty won't go out like John Gotti. He came from the caves to destroy everybody, and we like fools destroy our own bodies. Too many niggas chilling, bad boys boom boom. This leaves no room for the flowers to bloom. Seeds blow in the wind, another drug killing. What are we accomplishing? Nothing. What's the matter? Why every time I look around, another brain gets splattered? Some pockets get fatter, but it don't matter. The devil's the only one who really is fatter. Lead ruptures flesh, spleens are shattered, dreams are shattered. Another queen without a king. What will our children become without proper guidance? Probably nothing. So ain't the devil happy? Ain't the devil happy? A state of nothingness, hopelessness, lifelessness. If you're in range, I hope you hear this and try to change this, cause it's disastrous. Who gets the most loot? Who gets bust? Dollar bill, y'all, is the god we trust. The days blow by like dust, even men of steel rust. We're out here acting ridiculous when only we can save us. Mentally enslave us for little or nothing. Kill our neighbors. Animalistic, cannibalistic behavior. Look to the sky for your savior. He won't save ya. He didn't save your forefathers. Why bothers, brothers? You must discover the power of self. Know thyself or find thyself. Hating thyself, killing thyself. While he collects the wealth that you sit back and murder for. Ain't the devil happy?
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me, us. We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Greetings, greetings, greetings. Welcome to another episode of Real Life Radio Show. I am your host, Jenna Kepra, alongside my co-host, Brother Roz. Today is June the 4th. Hope you are having a great first of the month. New beginnings. For me in particular, there have been things going on. But luckily, Brother Roz has been here to hold down the fort. Brother Roz, how are you doing today?
Hey, it's great to be here with you and everyone else, the callers and listeners. It's awesome. I'm still learning, as always. But it is a good evening so far, and it's been a pretty crazy day, but it's a good evening. How's everything with you?
Well, man, everything is well. Just great. A little more time consuming, but, you know, we adjust.
Yeah.
We adjust. Tonight's topic, man, it was interesting, the conversation we had, that which in turn became tonight's show.
Repetitiveness. Sure.
When something is repeated enough, it becomes true. And if we run down through history, you can just throw a dart. It all starts with a tale or a fable, and people fight and kill over it. And we are right down to today doing the same things.
Absolutely.
And the different articles and stories that we will go over tonight will have that same repetitive theme attached to them. So where would you like to start?
I guess we could probably go into the clips first. There's some really good ones here. We're going to start with, and it's really short, but the one that says, "My teacher told my nephew that he's brown, not black. His response is priceless." After that, I would say the next one should probably be, where is it? Oh yeah. After that one would be, most people die at 24.
Okay.
After that would be how to brainwash a nation. After that would be Malcolm X's last interview. And then the last one would be honoring your ancestors.
So let's go ahead then.
Matter of fact, let's switch the first two. Put the most people die at 24 first, and then my nephew's teacher told him he was brown, and the response was priceless, and then everything else in the order that we just discussed.
Okay.
All right, cool.
Before you go, I need you to... never mind.
You sure? Everything's good?
Yeah.
Okay,
I just wanted to do that real quick. Just some back end stuff over here I had to take care of.
Okay.
Now, where is this? Okay, most people die. There we go.
Don't die while you're still alive. That's what my mentor told me, deep divers. And I take that everywhere I go. You see, most people die at 24 and aren't buried until 74. Meaning, they lose interest in life. They settle for a mediocre life. They settle for a boring ass job. They live according to society's expectations. They kill their curiosity. They kill their dreams and passions. Well, every single day, deep divers, I'm choosing to live while I am alive. Don't die before you have lived, deep divers. Realize today, you can turn the car around and become your greatest version. And once you do, well, you'll just say, "Feels so good to be alive, baby. Can I get a hello there?" Don't die before you have lived. Keep learning, keep growing, keep elevating.
Feel when she told you that you're not black.
Bad. But when I was playing with my friends, Noah and Gary, when I said we're all black, my crusty toe teacher, Miss Margarita, said I am brown. I can't believe she said I'm brown. How could she say I'm brown? I am literally black. I am a black young kid, 5-year-old. How could she ever say that to me? That is not how the teachers act, though.
Our conversation is with Mr. Yuri Alexandrovich Bezmianov. Mr. Bezmianov was born in 1939 in a suburb of Moscow. He was the son of a high-ranking Soviet Army officer. He was educated in the elite schools inside the Soviet Union and became an expert in Indian culture and Indian languages. He had an outstanding career with Novosti, which was the, and still is, I should say, the press arm or the press agency of the Soviet Union. It turns out that this is also a front for the KGB. He escaped to the West in 1970 after becoming totally disgusted with the Soviet system, and he did this at great risk to his life. He certainly is one of the world's outstanding experts on the subject of Soviet propaganda and disinformation and active measures. When the Soviets use the phrase ideological subversion, what do they mean by it?
Ideological subversion is the process which is legitimate, overt, and open. You can see it with your own eyes. All you have to do, all American mass media has to do, is to unplug their bananas from their ears, open up their eyes, and they can see it. There is no mystery. There is nothing to do with espionage. I know that espionage intelligence gathering looks more romantic. It sells more deodorants through the advertising, probably. That's why your Hollywood producers are so crazy about James Bond type of thrillers. But in reality, the main emphasis of the KGB is not in the area of intelligence at all. According to my opinion and opinion of many defectors of my caliber, only about 15% of time, money, and manpower is spent on espionage as such. The other 85% is a slow process which we call either ideological subversion or active measures, активные мероприятия in the language of the KGB, or psychological warfare. What it basically means is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite of the abundance of information, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interests of defending themselves, their families, their community, and their country. It's a great brainwashing process which goes very slow, and it's divided in four basic stages. The first one being demoralization. It takes from 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. Why that many years? Because this is the minimum number of years which requires to educate one generation of students in the country of your enemy, exposed to the ideology of the enemy. In other words, Marxism-Leninism ideology is being pumped into the soft heads of at least three generations of American students without being challenged or counterbalanced by the basic values of Americanism, American patriotism. The demoralization process in the United States is basically completed already. For the last 25 years, actually it's overfulfilled because demoralization now reaches such areas where previously not even Comrade Andropov and all his experts would even dream of such a tremendous success. Most of it is done by Americans to Americans, thanks to lack of moral standards. As I mentioned before, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. A person who was demoralized is unable to assess true information. The facts tell nothing to him. Even if I shower him with information, with authentic proof, with documents, with pictures, even if I take him by force to the Soviet Union and show him concentration camp, he will refuse to believe it until he is going to receive a kick in his fat bottom. When a military boot crashes his, then he will understand, but not before that. That's the tragic of the situation of demoralization. So the next stage is destabilization. This time, subverter does not care about your ideas and the patterns of your consumption. Whether you eat junk food and get fat and flabby, doesn't matter anymore. This time, and it takes only from 2 to 5 years to destabilize a nation, it's what matters is essentials: economy, foreign relations, defense systems. And you can see it quite clearly that in some areas, in such sensitive areas as defense and economy, the influence of Marxist-Leninist ideas in the United States is absolutely fantastic. I could never believe it 14 years ago when I landed in this part of the world that the process will go that fast. The next stage, of course, is crisis. It may take only up to 6 weeks to bring a country to the verge of crisis. You can see it in Central America now. And after crisis, with a violent change of power structure and economy, you have so-called the period of normalization. It may last indefinitely. Normalization is a cynical expression borrowed from Soviet propaganda. When the Soviet tanks moved into Czechoslovakia in 68, Comrade Brezhnev said, "Now the situation in brotherly Czechoslovakia is normalized." This is what will happen in the United States if you allow all these schmucks to bring the country to crisis, to promise people all kind of goodies and the paradise on earth, to destabilize your economy, to eliminate the principle of free market competition, and to put a big brother government in Washington, D.C., with benevolent dictators like Walter Mondale, who will promise lots of things, never mind whether the promises are fulfillable or not. Your leftists in the United States, all these professors and all these beautiful civil rights defenders, they are instrumental in the process of the subversion only to destabilize the nation. When their job is completed, they are not needed anymore. They know too much. Some of them, when they get disillusioned, when they see that Marxist-Lenin has come to power, obviously they get offended. They think that they will come to power. That will never happen, of course. They will be lined up against the wall and shot. But they may turn into the most bitter enemies of Marxist-Leninists when they come to power. And that's what happened in Nicaragua. You remember most of these former Marxist-Leninists were either put to prison or one of them split, and now he's working against Sandinistas. It happened in Grenada when Maurice Bishop was already a Marxist. He was executed by a new Marxist who was more Marxist than this Marxist. Same happened in Afghanistan when first there was Taraki, he was killed by Amin, then Amin was killed by Babrak Karmal with the help of KGB. Same happened in Bangladesh when Mujibur Rahman, very pro-Soviet leftist, was assassinated by his own Marxist-Leninist military comrades. It's the same pattern everywhere. It's divided in four basic stages: demoralization, destabilization, crisis, normalization. They will be lined up against the wall and shot, wall and shot, wall and shot.
We say Afro-American, they think only of the Negroes in the United States, but they don't realize that two-thirds of Brazil consist of people of African blood, which means they're also Afro-American because Brazil is in South America. And in all of these, many of these countries in South America, in Central America, and even in Canada, they are heavily populated with people whose ancestors came from Africa. So when you total up the number of Afro-Americans, real Afro-Americans, in the Western Hemisphere, there are perhaps 100 million. And if these people ever unite among themselves, not only is it necessary for the Afro-Americans in the United States to be organized, but it's also necessary for the Afro-Americans in the Caribbean, or the Afro-Cubans, the Afro-Brazilians. It's necessary for all of them to be organized. And then once they are organized in each place, we have to organize among ourselves so that the Afro-American in the United States will be working in conjunction in a coordinated program with those who are in Cuba and those in Brazil and those in Venezuela and those throughout the Caribbean and Haiti and in the West Indian Islands. And in this way, we actually get strength. And it's not an accident that there's no organization existing in the Western Hemisphere that's designed toward that end. It would be a direct threat to imperialism as it really exists and to colonialism as it exists in the West. And one of the things that's going to help to bring this about is the independence of Africa. And one of the only reasons in the that we in the West have never organized, we have hated our image and our African image. And because Africa has been in the hands of people who have created an image of Africa that's negative and hateful, and it has been hateful to us. We haven't wanted to identify with it. But now that Africa is getting independent and in a position to create its own image, and it's a positive image, those of us in the West look at the African image and see how positive it is, and we begin to identify with it. We become proud of Africa, and we become proud of our African blood, our African heritage. And this is what is beginning to make the Africans in the Western Hemisphere today develop more race pride. And as this race pride develops, then it has a tendency to make us want to unite together and work together. And your Western imperialists and colonialists consider this to be a grave threat. More threat than communism or Marxism or socialism or anything else. The Africanism is what they consider to be the real threat.
And what is the actual situation in the United States, where over 20 million colored people virtually live as a colonized nation under racist and economic oppression?
Well, for the past 10 years, the struggle in America has been confined to what has been projected to the public as a civil rights struggle. And in that context, it has remained a domestic problem. It has remained within the jurisdiction of the United States. And it has, and as such, it has been impossible for the Afro-Americans or American Negroes to try and enlist the support of other dark-skinned people who are being oppressed the world over in that struggle. And the difference now in the direction that the struggle is taking, from the direction that the struggle has been going in the past, there are many of our people who are thinking more deeply and more broadly and are beginning to see the importance of lifting it out of the national context or out of the domestic context or beyond the jurisdiction of the United States government. And the only way this can be done is by internationalizing the problem and putting it at a level where it can be taken into the United Nations. And then all of the other independent nations on this earth can involve themselves in our struggle and support us. And the only way by which this can be done, instead of it being called civil rights in the future, we're going to have to label it a human rights struggle or the struggle for human rights. And as such, we can then take it into the United Nations through the avenues that have been set up by the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. We can take our problem before the United Nations in the same manner that the problem of South Africa, Angola, Mozambique, Hungary, the Arab refugee problem, it becomes a world problem. And as a world problem, then the Afro-American or the so-called Negroes equal results because it's not left up to the one who's responsible for it anymore, but it's put at a level where the whole can see that our plight is wrong. It stood in our path in the past. It also makes a difference in the leadership. Those who have been posing as leaders of our people in America in the past, they can pose on this local stage where Uncle Sam is the master of the show and can prop them up and make them look good or make them look better than they actually are by giving them token gains and building them up an image. But when they step onto the international stage or the world stage, then Uncle Sam can't prop them up anymore. And their ability or lack of ability becomes exposed. And if they can lead us forward, they remain leaders. But if they can't, then they have to step aside, and more qualified and bona fide leaders step up from the masses of our people, and then we get more, we get faster progress. We get more results.
Malcolm X came from the masses as a genuine leader of his people. He was well aware of the false divisions planted between them, for he himself had overcome many of these artificial barriers to emerge as a voice which raised our strongest demands for freedom and justice in America. This man combined his recognition of the chief enemy of the African and Afro-American people with an objective knowledge of where our strength lay. He talks about the black intellectual. He talks about education, revolutionary education. He talks about the tasks of our women.
Well, in the past, the Afro-American or American Negro intellectual permitted himself to be used in a way that wasn't really beneficial to the overall Afro-American struggle. But I think today that these intellectuals have begun to undertake a new appraisal of the problem, looking at it as it actually is, and are beginning to see it more in the international context and the relation that it has with the African struggle. And the African intellectual is beginning to look at the problem in the African context and see that what might be good in one country, in order for it to be used in another country, has to be rearranged. You take African socialism. Many of the African intellectuals that have analyzed the approach of socialism are beginning to see where the African has to use a form of socialism that's that fits into the African context, whereas the form that is used in a European country might be good for that particular European country. It doesn't fit as well into the African context. So I think the African intellectual is making that contribution, and he's making it well. One thing that I became aware of in my traveling recently through Africa and the Middle East, in every country that you go to, usually the degree of progress can never be separated from the woman. If you're in a country that's progressive, the woman is progressive. If you're in a country that reflects a consciousness toward the importance of education, it's because the woman is aware of the importance of education. But in every backward country, you'll find the women are backward. And in every country where education is not stressed, it's because the women don't have education. So one of the things I became thoroughly convinced of in my recent travels is the importance of giving freedom to the woman, giving her education, and giving her the incentive to get out there and put that same spirit and understanding in the children. And I frankly am proud of the contribution that our women have made in the struggle for freedom. And I'm one person who's for giving them all of the leeway possible, because they've made a greater contribution than many of us men. And one of the best ways that they can help is to encourage the man, try and inspire him to be more militant, and turn him away from being nonviolent and passive and meek and Uncle Tomish. Make him aware that the black woman wants to see her man be a man instead of around here using religion as an excuse to be a coward, and some of the things that he's been reflecting here lately. The Organization of Afro-American Unity sees the only hope for the black man in America in a strong Africa, and the necessity of the Afro-American becoming inseparably linked with the overall program that's existing on the African continent. The two problems must be solved together, and the two forces must go forward together. And so the Organization of Afro-American Unity has a program to link the Afro-Americans with the Africans and the Africans with the Afro-Americans. When I say Afro-Americans, I mean those throughout the entire Western Hemisphere. This is our only hope. Our hope is in a strong Africa. And when Africa is strong, our position in America will be one of respect. But if Africa is weak, we will never be in a position of respect in America.
On a related note to this topic of tradition, I'd like to know if you could share about the ancestors and the importance that the ancestors hold in your approach to the sacred.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, this is a 6-week workshop you just asked about. But, you know, in terms of a quick answer, we have to acknowledge the blood that's flowing through our veins and the predispositions, the gifts, and the liabilities of what is in our DNA. That's looking at our biological ancestors. And a lot of people don't want to do this, you know, because there is pain and shame there and all of that. To that part of it, I say, you do not heal a sore by ignoring it. It will only fester. Everybody has somebody in the family line, who you'd rather not be related to them. But, you know, you got the same thing running through your veins, and it definitely informs and impacts you, even if it's no more than to repress you because you don't want to identify with it. Then we have, you know, ancestors of affinity, those who we are attracted to, that has nothing to do with blood kinship. You know, I feel very at home in Southeast Asia and in New Zealand, and I can't tell you why. I just love, you know, I love the place, I love the people, I love the culture. Who knows? And then in order to really be human, we need to learn how to reach across to those who we think are so unlike us. If we track it back far enough, we find that everybody at one time or another was indigenous to the planet and connected to nature before our history started pulling us away. If we track it back far enough, we find out through mitochondrial DNA that we are all, we did all come out of Africa. And in this world at this time, we really have to take a look at the fact that we are the ancestors of the future, and what we do now will have that impact. So just in a thinking way, that's important. But in practical ancestor reverence, I want to say that the intelligence and the emotions and the actions and the energy of the ancestors has not gone away. Just because the body may be laying in a coffin under the earth, hopefully not so embalmed that it takes too long to return to soil, but the consciousness of that person exists as capsules of energy in the atmosphere. And when a person learns the right, put yourself in the right attitude, and learns the right invocations, and learns to ask for guidance and assistance for human beings who have walked the way I'm walking or deal with what I'm dealing with, I call upon the surviving intelligence of those to inform and guide me. I'm going to tell you how amazing this is. Two examples. In my class at ITP, one of the women came in with a basket of acorns, right? And as the day passed, she was cleaning up the altar and said, "Tish, would you like to have these?" Okay. One of the ancestors on my shrine is a spirit who was involved in Underground Railroad and liberating people from plantations and things. And she always asked for acorn bread. So getting acorn flour is something that I often have. This woman don't know nothing about me and my ancestors, but here, have a basket of acorns. So that same basket of acorns is sitting on my shrine, and another woman who knows nothing about it comes, walks past my shrine, goes in the other room. We're sitting there talking, and she says, "Tisha, you know, I don't mean to be presumptuous or nothing, but you know, I keep getting the feeling that there is a young Indian woman who's trying to tell me to say something to you, and this is her message." You know, and the woman's apologizing. I said, "Don't apologize. Just tell me what she's saying." "The message is from my mother's mother, who's a Choctaw woman who made a cornbread." You see what I'm saying? And it teaches you to pay attention to the patterns that are unfolding in your life, okay? If I have sat in front of my ancestor shrine and asked for a specific thing, it puts me on yellow alert to take a good look at every person that I meet, because they are going to answer me through the medium of another human being. When you get to that level with it, you are never, ever alone. And I want to say to the people who feel like, you know, there may be some monsters in your ancestry, there are ways to heal that. There are ways to heal that energy. To the ones who say, "Oh, I'm just a Heinz 57 variety mutt," I've heard that. That's not true. And that attitude is impacting your self-esteem. To the ones who say, "Well, my ancestors allowed me to fall into oppression," everybody, from what I can tell, everybody at one time or another has oppressed somebody else and themselves. And at this point in human history, we really need to get over it. We really need to stop it.
That leads me to the next question. I hear you saying that the work, although it's difficult, is well worth it to get to know and love our specific family ancestors. Yes. I'm wondering also what you've noticed in your decades of doing ancestor work with and for others, how you've seen working with the ancestors to bring medicine for healing collective poisons like sexism, racism, homophobia, etc.
There's another one of them 12-week classes that you want. We have a national ceremony called the Ma'afa, M-A-A-F-A. The Ma'afa is done on the seaboards of New York, of the Carolinas, of Louisiana, at the seashore, even here in the Bay Area. And the Ma'afa is designed to resurrect, honor, and reclaim the energy of the people who either leaped overboard or were thrown overboard during the Middle Passage. Millions of people were thrown in the ocean as human cargo. That whole journey of sacrificing humans into the ocean was so severe that it changed the nature of the sharks in the ocean. Okay. The people who are the descendants, the survivors of that journey, many of us have what is called transgenerational slave syndrome. And a wonderful social scientist named Dr. Joy DeGuy Leary has done studies on that and is brilliantly articulating how both the descendants of the slaves and the descendants of the slave sellers and buyers have been affected by that whole thing. We have the DeWolf family. There's a film out called Tales of the Deep North. And it is about a young white woman who discovered that her great-grandfather had slaves in Rhode Island, not Mississippi, in Rhode Island, you know. And her and her uncle, her and her family, traced it all the way back to Africa and went to that village. They have been traveling around showing the film and holding groups of people, black and white people, with the primary question being, this action of enslavement injured the people who were enslaved and also dehumanized the people who did the slaving. Okay. And so both are wounded by this. And the question that they put forth is, what would healing look like? And so, you know, on a national and in some cases international level, ancestor reverence as medicine is healing, working to heal racism. You know, that is amazing that we now have enough information about our respective histories and enough consciousness to know that this needs to be healed. You know, I think that those two stand out as the contemporary national examples of that work. It's huge. It's huge. And we have to keep doing it.
All right. Now we're about 15 minutes into the first break, Roz. You wanna start or just what you wanna do?
I guess we could just do a quick break and then just move forward from there. So I'll do it right now. You're listening to Real Life, the radio program with myself, Ross, and my co-host, Jenna Kepra. If you do wish to call in and ask a question or make a comment, please give us a call at 719-284-5271. And the code is 70637. Again, that's 719-284-5271. And the code is 70637. Press star 61 if you wish to ask a question or make a comment. I was having a senior brain moment there for a second. Was there anything you wanted to address before, you know, I go through the videos? Was there anything you wanted to comment on in regards to that?
Well, just I go through just what I had real quick. The first one,
okay.
The first one probably being the most important to me, just with understanding why we treat ourselves, and actually when this actual interview, 1985, they was already halfway through. So changed the perception of all Americans. They didn't select a few or section it off. They attacked the entire nation. And like they stated, 1 through 4, demoralize, separate the country's forces, crisis, normalization. And we can see all of that happening right now. I just want to make sure everybody keep those four, not just for tonight, but just as you pay attention to everything that's going on and how people look at you crazy for noticing it. Let's see.
Yeah.
Malcolm X, as always, almost like a prophet, you know, just predicting what he's seen coming from everything that's happened in his time and where it was headed then versus where it's at now. I think a lot of that was hid from a lot of us for too long. We in the information age now and everything is available, but we're so screwed up at times that we don't know what to look for. So
I agree.
At least that's been one of my problems. I don't speak for everybody. That's just my, that's the problem I had. The ancestor honoring. Now, this is something particular that you and me have had private conversations on, where you, I would tell you about a certain situation, and you would point out things that I had that you would see from the outside looking in, and when I would go back and look at these things, I didn't want to believe them, but I could see it. It's hard to, you know what I'm saying? It's hard to put into words how you can understand that. So I know you're going to get into that tonight. But I can't wait to hear what you got. Let's go. I ask questions as we go.
No problem. I'll start with the child who was told by his teacher he was not black but brown and his reaction. The reason I thought that was important is because over 75% of the people who teach our children are white females. And always remember that when a teacher is in front of your child, they are a surrogate parent to your child. So, and of course, the idea is to train your child to give them similar respect that they would give to you as a parent if you were there teaching them. So if you have a white woman actually telling a black child that they're not black, they're brown, there right there is the psychological indoctrination towards disliking part of themselves or even not wanting to acknowledge that part of themselves. And that's just minute. All they're saying is that you're not black, you're brown, but that can go as far as just saying, something totally different. Why do you want to be black? Because, you know, black people have this reputation. All of these things, and it could be subliminal. It doesn't have to be overt. But that my child is about 5 years old or six years old. So the perception level of that child, and this was the same child who, like, I think 2 to 3 weeks earlier, questioned his aunt about his skin color. And she addressed it because he said, well, you know, I'm light skinned. I'm not dark like you. I'm not black, pretty much was his initial thought, just on looking at himself and looking at his aunt. And she had to actually school this child, her nephew, on what it means to be black. And after that, weeks later, his teacher told him he wasn't black and he had the proper response. So it has to do with actually teaching your child who they are on a basic level and them having the confidence to, even in a situation where their teacher, an authority, a surrogate mother, quote unquote, is telling them they're not who they are, they know well enough who they are that they can articulate it for themselves and say to them, oh, you can't tell me who and what I am. That doesn't work. And that's exactly what that child did, because his aunt was able to answer his questions that he had. And I think a lot of black people don't like to answer those questions because we have, some of us, I would say, have questionable conversations in the presence of our children. We'll talk about good hair or, you know, light skin versus dark skin and all the other coloristic things that we tend to do. And the children are an earshot of that. So there's a racial confusion that starts very young, and usually it starts in the house, depending on who the parents are raising that child or who the people are that that child is allowed to be around and conversations that they're an earshot to hear. So to me, it was just a great example of someone young, extremely young, who was thinking. So when his teacher did actually say something to him that did not resonate with truth, he was able to correct it, not be rude, not be disrespectful, but just say, no, you can't tell me who and what I am. I know that I'm black. And it was just a beautiful thing to see this young child actually articulate themselves in a very, very potent way to be so young. So after that, I will go to, How to Brainwash a Nation, which is what you were talking about, 1985, the Russian, I guess they called him a Russian spy, but he did way more than just spying. Now, there's a few things that he said that were quite powerful to me. So he said that it took 15 years for them to indoctrinate one generation of American people. That means all Americans, into accepting Marxism and Leninism over American ideals. And it's funny because over this entire year, I've been watching a lot of economic videos dealing with the collapse and news information about what's actually happening from world-renowned economists. And there's one named Richard Wolff. And he has said in multiple videos that, and he's also like a historian and an economist. And he talked about the fact that Marxism is literally a major part of what America is right now. And he went through the history of it in one video. It was like a 2 hours, something plus long video, where he actually said exactly what this man said about how it infiltrated the society and has become so normalized, people are unable to separate what they would call the original old American ideology versus Marxism and Leninism. Even when you go back to the Black Panthers, they talked about Marxism, they talked about socialism, their programs that they created, the WIC program. A lot of people don't know that. That stands for Woman, Infant, and Child. It was the Black Panthers who created that. The school lunch program. These would be considered socialist programs. Even though they did a lot of good, people would consider them socialist programs because people eventually, once the government took this idea from the Black Panthers and instated it across the country, then you're talking about, you know, for some people, reduced lunch, for other children's free lunch and breakfast, that whole thing. And a lot of people would call that socialism, but it's a part of our society and it's completely a part of the fabric of the society now. So he talked about the 15 years that it takes just to train one generation. They've trained multiple generations in this way, and to the point where the average American citizen doesn't really understand what they think and why they think it, because they've been so successfully indoctrinated through the educational system, which is what he talked about, was infiltrating the educational system and spreading this ideology. Now, the crazy part about it, too, is that he talked about the fact that it got to the point where they were so successful that you had Americans informing and misinforming other Americans. So you had American teachers teaching Marxist and Russian ideologies to the populace for them. So all they had to do was get a foothold, infiltrate the education of the society, and then the teachers did the rest. And to me, like, when I look at that, right, it kind of ties into what, let me see one second. And before I go further, what he talked about was the fact that when these ideologies were placed into the American society, they were unchallenged. So nobody was coming out speaking against these things at all. It was just something that became accepted, which leads to what you were talking about, the normalization process, which he discussed. Now, to me, there was a situation that happened on Black Junction, and Scotty and I got into the conversation, and it ties into this. And it has to do with the so-called aboriginals, these people who are Black people who are claiming to be aboriginal to America. Now, Scotty had a discussion with brother and sister Davis regarding that whole ideology. I don't know how it came up because I didn't hear the show, but I'm just assuming maybe they had said something to the effect of Black people had been here, you know, before what we know as Native Americans today. I think that was the gist of it. I don't know. It was just something that he wrote about, and I was just taking the context of it based on how he wrote it on BTR Community. And he had talked about the fact, and he posted a video, I believe I posted it like you talked about, Jenna, with David Imhotep discussing the fact that Africans have been in America since 51,700 BC. And over time, around 12,000 BC, 13,000 BC, you had pretty much Black Asians who came across the Bering Strait and came into American society and mixed with the original Blacks that were here. And you're talking about the San people or Khoisan people, which they've genetically shown literally people the entire planet. And they're the most genetically diverse people on Earth. And not just Africans on the continent, but even out of all of the Africans on the continent, those people in South Africa are the most genetically diverse people on the planet. And Africans in general are the most genetically diverse people on the planet. But they're like at the highest echelon of genetic diversity because they peopled the planet. And he talked about the fact that when these people came in, these Asians came in around 13,000 BC, that they came in such large ways that they fully absorbed that original black population, which is how they got to that dark reddish with the Asiatic features that we know typically phenotypically are what we call Native Americans. So it doesn't mean that there were no black Native Americans. It means that the overwhelming majority of those Native Americans were actually Asiatic with some semblance of admixture from the original Africans that they absorbed. So he was talking about he kind of talked about that history. And a lot of the information that is being propagated by some of the Aboriginal community is completely antithesis to what the actual facts, genetics, and everything else actually speaks to. And a lot of it really ties into like creating this new identity for themselves that doesn't make sense when you start to dig deeper. Now, there was a black female who had posted a meme on Black Junction. And in the meme, it was a picture of South Africans fighting British in the Battle of Isandlwana. And I knew the image from many, many years ago because I'm a African historian, so I've come across it before. And it was actually an image that was put out by National Geographic that was painted. And it showed South Africans with their cowhide shields and spears, basically looking like they're about to attack a standing white male with dead white men around him. And this person put in the meme, these are Indians who were fighting early British who settled America. Look how these Indians don't look like the white Indians that we typically see, or something to that effect. And I actually had to correct that misinformation by putting the actual information regarding National Geographic as the ones who actually put out this image and all the details that went along with it. And it was so disingenuous that they would take this image of African people and superimpose a Aboriginal identity on these people. And I said that we're becoming what we had to endure. So if people repeat this enough, then it starts to seem so real. And then you get a whole bunch of people who don't have the time or don't care to take the time to do their due diligence. They just hear confirmation bias. I believe that I'm Aboriginal here. This person is saying it. They're showing me these images and telling me, they're not vetting the image. They're just saying, they're telling me that these were what the original Indians looked like. So I believe it because that's how I've conditioned myself over however long the length of time is to believe that this is true. And to me, it just shows that same thing where you have black people misinforming other black people. And as a result, there's this self-fulfilling prophecy that becomes an anti-African narrative that shows up in some of the information propagated by the so-called Aboriginals that we hear talking all the time. And it ties into the same concept that the Russian spy talked about. It was demoralization, destabilization, crisis, and then normalization, right? So black people were destabilized. They destabilized the continent. Kidnapped people, also had some Africans involved in that process, buying and selling their own people. They demoralized them through the physical attack. They destabilized them through the slave trade itself, created a crisis situation where a lot of Africa's talent, mental and physical, was kidnapped, either killed or kidnapped and taken across the water to the Western Hemisphere. And then after the crisis, they normalized the abuse of black people in our own psyche and the hatred of blackness in the psyche of black people, which plays itself out in things like that Aboriginal thing that I was just talking about. So you find these tactics have a very, very powerful and intense control over the minds of many black people. And that's why I always say they never do anything new. They just pretty much refine it and become better at doing the criminal things that they do. And a lot of us adopt these same things and do it to each other because we can't do it to the actual enemy. So it's easier to do it to each other. And because of the fact that being black today is synonymous with slavery, a lot of us want to run from that identity completely, like Minister Malcolm talked about so eloquently in his clip. So that was one thing I wanted to discuss. The other thing was in Malcolm X's interview, he said something really powerful that he, in his mind, he tied the treatment of black people in the West directly to the treatment of people on the African continent, which is something that he did on multiple occasions. Now, mind you, that piece that we heard was his last interview before he got killed. So in that interview, if you ever read a book called The Judas Factor, The Plot to Kill Malcolm X by Carl Evans, he talks about the fact that Malcolm was killed for just what he said in that clip, that he wanted to make unite black people in the Western Hemisphere, directly connect them to the African continent, as well as other oppressed people globally, and then go to the international court at the United Nations and charge the U.S. and other European powers with human rights abuses for the genocide, death, destruction, and continued mistreatment of non-white people globally. And they made it emphatically clear in that book that that was why the government wanted him killed. They released the CIA documents and FBI documents that said the same thing. And that was his last interview. So he laid the cards out so clear in that last interview. Just weeks later, they took him out. And he also tied into this as well, that the degree to which a society is progressive is directly linked to how progressive the woman is treated. And that when you find that a society is ignorant and backwards, you find that the woman is ignorant and backwards. And in societies that are progressive and making strides towards doing really good things, you find that the women are educated, the women are completely supported because they're the ones who teach the babies. So if the original teacher is in a good state, it's only common sense that her children are going to be in a good state and their children and so on and so forth. So that is an intimate thing. If you just look at it from a basic human family standpoint, and then you tie that to Africans and African Americans, or American Africans, as I like to call them, and their connection to one another, as you know, Africa being the place that they were taken from and brought here, then it's the same parent-child relationship. And one thing that I said, and I think Scotty and I talked about it briefly, or Scotty might have posted on it, and then I chimed in, if I remember correctly, was that African countries need to actually go to international court to sue for reparations on behalf of the people who were kidnapped from their countries and brought to the Western Hemisphere. And that's something I believed emphatically from day one, because how international crimes are charged is that a country has to bring charges against another country. So if you have people kidnapped from Ghana, Ghana needs to go take the U.S. to international court and sue for reparations that are due to those Ghanaian descendants who reside in the United States. Same for Cameroon and Nigeria and Benin and all these other countries. You have to have that direct connection, and that will also help to foster unity between those in the diaspora who ended up in the Western Hemisphere and those who are still on the African continent who we have direct genetic connection to and historical connection to. So that was something else I wanted to tie into this whole thing. And I think that because now we're getting into the next thing, we're dealing with the honoring the ancestors. Now, she talked about something really powerful, and something that I heard Dr. Ben say back in like the early 80s. She talked about the fact, and many other African scholars have talked about this too, from Anthony Browder to Dr. Clark as well, and many others, that so many slaves were thrown overboard on the way from the west coast of Africa to the Caribbean and the rest of the Western Hemisphere, that it changed the nature of the predatory behavior of the sharks. And what they're talking about is the fact that so many dead black people, or people committed suicide, or people who were thrown overboard because they were sick and they didn't want the infection to spread before they could make the 2-month trip to the United States, or to the Americas, I should say. The sharks used to follow the slave ships, waiting for bodies to be thrown overboard so they could tear them apart. It completely like demolished their predatory instinct, because there was free food everywhere. And Dr. Ben talked about, this was in the 80s, he said that from space, there was a white line you could see that followed the Canary Currents, and I forget the other currents that take you from the west coast of Africa directly to the Caribbean, And they also are currents that take you from the Caribbean back to Africa. But for the currents that take you specifically, which is the Canary Current, is one of them, directly from West Africa to the Caribbean, that there was a white line that they were able to see from space that was a calcium line from the bones of those ancestors that were eaten, and their bodies fell to the bottom of the ocean eventually, and those bones became pulverized, because the deeper you get into the ocean, the more intense the pressure is. So bones actually get crushed and pulverized over time. And he said there was in one of his lectures, a calcium line that was discernible that followed those currents from West Africa here. And she talked about that, which I thought was really, really powerful, to just let you give you some kind of understanding of the carnage that was involved in this transatlantic slave trade. And she talked about the fact that when your ancestors passed, that they are droplets of energy that remain in the world, and you can reach out to them and communicate with them and have their intercession and get their assistance. So you're talking about the fact that, again, energy is not created or destroyed, just transformed. So for people who understand ancestral reverence and that intimate connection between you and your ancestors, you usually have experiences to go along with that. And it really, really ties into the fact that we have people who we are genetically related to that came before us. They lived the life that human beings live, and they ended up, you know, dying and becoming ancestors. And because when we study the history of the Africans that were brought here, none of them practiced Christianity at all. They were either Muslim or they practiced African traditional religion. And when I say that, specifically dealing with the Western Hemisphere, as far as the United States, the Caribbean, Central and South America, those people practiced literally almost the same tradition, just practiced by different parts of the continent. So you had people who practiced Vodun from Benin that were brought here. You have the people who practiced the Orisha tradition, or the Ifa tradition of Ifa of the Yoruba people, which has the exact same pantheon of deities. The names are pretty much the same in everything. You had the Akan, same thing. The deities are the same, and the practice was pretty much the same. And then when you got here, those people who were not Christian and who were not Muslim actually syncretized their religion, because they couldn't practice their African religion openly, or they would be killed or severely abused. So what they did was they connected the Christian saints to deities that they corresponded to, as far as the African gods had corresponding saints in the Christian tradition. So they superimposed these Christian saints on their deities, and in secret, they would speak in their African language, talk to their deities in their African tongue, and stop using the Christian names. But in front of the master, they would call on Saint Santa Barbara, or they would call on Saint Michael or Gabriel or whichever one. And each one of them has a corresponding Orisha that in the African tradition that was maintained all the way until today. So, and a lot of people don't understand it. A lot of these deities were actually people. Shango was a real king that actually lived, and he became a deity. Just like Imhotep was an actual doctor. He's the world's oldest and first documented multi-genius. And when he died, he became the father of medicine. When you say the Hippocratic Oath in the medical system, you end up calling the name of Asclepius. Asclepius is the Greek rendition of the name of Imhotep. So Hippocrates even pays homage to an African priest scientist who was also a vizier for the second pharaoh, Zoser. And a vizier is pretty much the equivalent to the vice president. And he became a deity that was worshipped for over 2,000 years. Greeks used to come to his temples, as well as Nile Valley Africans and other Africans in the surrounding area, to pay him homage because his medical skills were so renowned. And mind you, he wasn't the only doctor. Both of his parents before him were also doctors. But he was the most well-documented doctor in ancient times. That's why he's known as the world's oldest documented multi-genius and medical practitioner, because his legend was that powerful. But when you study his history, you'll find both his mother and father were also doctors, which reminds me of Dr. Welsing. She came from an intergenerational medical practitioner family, her grandfather, her father, and then herself. So it all lines up when you really start to pay attention. Now, what this is that you know, you are nothing but a replica of your ancestors. That's how you get your physical appearance. You usually look like either one of your parents, your mother or father, or someone connected to them, whether it's a grandparent, an uncle, or whatever. You'll find physical affinities because you are a genetic copy of those people who came before you. And all of your potentiality is lined up with that genetic material that made you who you are. You are that special sperm in however many millions upon millions, it's usually a tablespoon of sperm that men ejaculate. You are that one special sperm that made it to the egg and united with the egg in order to create yourself. If it was a different sperm that entered your mother's egg, you would not be who you are. You would be someone else. So all of that genetic material on a micro level has come together to create your book of life, which is you, the physical you. And the interesting part about that is when you tie it in, it ties directly into the concepts of the genetic, or what I would call, me personally, the genetic foundation of nature. So all things in nature are made up of atoms, right? And the first atom of them all you find on the periodic chart is hydrogen. Every other atom that exists, whether it's for steel, titanium, iron, gold, which is written as AU, silver, which is written, if I remember correctly, is AG on the periodic chart. All of those are different variant combinations of the hydrogen atom. They either add electrons or add protons in order to switch and become these other things. So when you get to it, hydrogen is the genetic foundation of the world that we live in. All you have to do is just take those protons and electrons and rearrange them with different numbers, you know, and what you'll get is different elements that we experience using every day. So when you think about it that way, the atom is the chromosomal structure of the universe. That is that one thing that you can basically alchemically mix and match protons and electrons and get different elements that we see in the world and use to survive and just live our daily lives. And the ancestors are that same. I don't know how I got muted, but I got muted, so I had to unmute myself. I apologize for that. So they are literally that book of life, that genetic blueprint. And if a different sperm met that ovum, there would be a slightly different set of genetic material that would have made up who you are, and you would not be the exact person that you are today. So when you get into the ancestors and their importance, the thing about it is that in Western religions, they don't have a codified system of ancestral reverence. It's only the adherent going directly to the deity. And in African traditional religions, the ancestors come even before the deity. I've been to many, many ceremonies of the Yoruba people, and you always pay homage to the ancestors before any Orisha. It's the ancestors first, then you pay homage to what's known as the road opener deity, which is Eshu or Legba, and then from there you will pay respect to any of the other Orisha. That's the hierarchy of how it goes. And even when the sister was talking about the Ma'afa and going to the shores of New York City, and she talked about Louisiana and the West Coast where she was, the Bay Area, that these are ceremonies that happen every year. My family's been to many of those. We haven't been in a couple of years now, but we've been to them before. And you go right to the edge of the ocean. They usually have candles, white flowers, which the color white directly leads to the ancestors. Funny enough, a lot of people don't know, when you study traditional Africa and go all the way back to the Nile Valley, the color white is associated with death. That's why when you go to when you look at the temples in Egypt, you'll find that all of the deceased people are wearing white robes, or they're wrapped in white mummy cloth, because that signifies the fact that they are no longer living. Hey, whenever you question. See a statue, and it, go ahead.
What's the significance of them going to the ocean?
The significance is to pay their respects and reverence for those ancestors who did not make it. So for all of those ancestors that you are genetically connected to that ended up in the Atlantic Ocean and never made it here, it's to pay respect to them because they never got a proper burial. They were terrified because they were taken from the place that was normal to them and taken to the West. And in many African traditional societies, the West is associated with the world of the dead. In Kemet, to go West was what the ancestors did. So the overwhelming majority, especially of the Middle Kingdom, Later Kingdom burial sites are all on the western bank of the Nile. And all of the living structures are on the eastern bank of the Nile. And even for West African ethnic groups, going west was where the ancestors went when you passed away. So they were terrified because they didn't know where they were going. And they were being taken to what they would have perceived as the world of the ancestors, going west like that. And they also got dumped in the ocean, or they chose to kill themselves rather than to be enslaved. So these people need to be lifted up. So that's the reason you leave those offerings. That's the reason you say those prayers. And what you'll find is, as you go to those ceremonies, everybody's wearing white, the cleanest, purest white you can see. The flowers are white, like carnations and other white flowers, flowers that don't have thorns. You might have white candles. Sometimes there'll also be blue candles because the deity that's in charge of the ocean is Yemaya in the Orisha tradition, which is Oset in the Kemetic tradition. So you pay that homage to them. And what you'll find is sometimes ancestors will possess certain people that are there for the ceremony. And they might actually speak through one of those people to one of their descendants that's there. So these are things that you'll come across and find take place in some of these ceremonies because of the importance of the ancestors. We've talked about the fact before that your ancestors are your pretty much like your lawyers in the world of the dead. So if there's anything like the sister said in the video, you know, if you're unclear in what you're asking the creator for, or asking for his, her, because I don't believe God is a male at all, the deity, and I don't call the deity God at all, the deity is male and female in balanced combination. So whenever you have a problem articulating what you need, it is your ancestors who will take that to the deity. And because those ancestors in some cases also speak the language, which is another important thing. They speak the old language, so they can go and intercede on your behalf. So if you're speaking English and it's an African deity that's used to the Yoruba language, they can convert what you're saying into something that's sensible, and they pretty much intercede on your behalf to get you whatever you need from the creator or from a specific deity. If there's a deity that's presiding over that situation that you're dealing with, whether it's Ogun or Shango or Oshun or Babaluwaye, you'll find that. Matter of fact, this is an interesting tidbit. Anybody who's old enough to remember I Love Lucy,
that song,
the theme song that you hear in the beginning of that, is actually an Orisha song. It is a song that actually belongs to the Yoruba deity Babaluwaye, who was also a king in ancient times. But that deity is the deity in charge of pestilence and smallpox. So a lot of doctors in the Yoruba culture would fall under his purview, as well as a couple of other deities. And that song, because Desi Arnaz was an initiate of Babaluwaye, and to pay homage to Babaluwaye, he made that theme song the theme song of I Love Lucy. So every show, when you hear a na-na-na-na-na-na-na, that is Babaluwaye being paid respect to every time you heard that song played on television. And most people don't know it. Desi Arnaz was also Cuban. In Cuba, the Cuban variation of the Orisha tradition is known as Lucumi. In Puerto Rico, it's known as Santeria. In South America and Brazil, it's known as Candomblé. In Trinidad, it used to be known as Shango Baptist, but they actually removed the syncretization in recent years. They wanted to completely separate from the Christian tradition, and they now call it the Orisha tradition of Trinidad and Tobago. So you see that these are pretty much the same. Haiti is called Vodun or Voodoo, depending on who you talk to. And in Louisiana, you have another variation of it that's called Hoodoo. And that has a little bit of the Native American spiritual and medicinal practices interspersed with the Orisha tradition down there. So you find it. It's here. And like I said, a lot of these deities were once people who their legend became so larger than life that they were given attributes of deities and became deities eventually themselves. And I wanted to get into some things regarding the ancestors, because when you start to really dig deep, and especially if you go to get readings done and you deal with priests or priestesses of different traditions, you'll find that the information that they have access to just by being so intimately in tune with nature and with our ancestors in the world of the dead, they'll find out things about you that you never told anybody. And it's funny because in that same book that I read a piece from last week, The Santeria Experience by Mahenny Gonzalez Whipler, she actually had an experience with one of her ancestors, and she was always terrified of dealing with the ancestors because she was averted to dealing with the dead. And there's a lot of us who are like that, but she tells her personal story, which I find to be quite, quite fascinating. And I think it'll kind of help people understand how this works on a different level. So this is on page 194. The chapter is called Itutu, or The Death of a Santero. And she says this, as soon as I entered her house, I knew my misgivings had been well-founded. Her dining table was covered with a white sheet, and around it were five people, including my madrina. Madrina is the mother of the initiatic house that you belong to. So in the Yoruba tradition, each madrina or padrina has their own house, which is called an ile. And all of the people that they initiate become their spiritual children. So she's talking about her madrina taking her to a place to see someone who's going to help her get in touch with her ancestors. So that, I just wanted to give people that understanding. So when you have a better understanding that each particular high priest, that's a male or female, has what's considered their ile or their house. And then every single person that they initiate become their spiritual children and fall into their spiritual descendancy lineage. So the same way that that person would pay homage to their mother, their father, their grandmother, they do the same for their mother or father in their ile. Even after they pass away, that madrina or padrina becomes an ancestor that you have to maintain contact with and respect in the world of the dead. So here we go. She says, as soon as I entered the house, I knew my misgivings had been well-founded. Her dining table was covered with a white sheet, and around it were five people, including my madrina. The lights were all low, and there were flowers and candles on the table, along with the inevitable. Hello, did somebody speak? Did you speak, Jenna?
No. Go ahead. I got some questions, but go ahead.
Okay, no problem. Thank you. So it says the lights were all low, and there were flowers and candles on the table, along with the inevitable Florida water. Florida water is something that we use to cleanse spaces, and sometimes as offerings to the dead as well, depending on how you set up your ancestral altar or ancestral space. So here we go. The Florida water. I immediately recognized all the ominous signs. Madrina, I told her as I handed her the items she had requested. Why didn't you tell me you were going to have a seance? You know I don't like calling upon the dead. I think they should be allowed to rest in peace. That's just the point, she said. They can't rest in peace if you don't help them find the light that they need. Ignoring my objection, she took her place at the head of the table and told me to sit by her side. My flowers were placed by themselves on a vase next to me. She lit one of the candles I had brought and one of those already on the table. The seance, which the Santeros call a misa espiritual, a spiritual mass, started with the typical lengthy collection of prayers which are read from the Spiritist devotionary compiled by the famed French spiritualist Alan Kardec. After the prayers, my madrina opened the bottle of Florida water and aspersed the table and all those who were sitting at it. Sitting down once more, she began to pray to the dead of my family and ask them to come forward. As soon as I heard my madrina begin to call on my personal dead, I became petrified. Although I had nothing but the deepest affection for the memories of those who had preceded me, the thought of establishing actual contact with any of them was to me quite unnatural. If any of them should actually manifest during the seance, I simply did not know how I would react. Sitting silently at my madrina's side, sweat pouring steadily down my back, I joined my hands over the table in an unconscious act of prayer. Immediately, my madrina told me, open my hands and lay them flat on the table. Quote, if you lock your hands together, she told me in a low voice, you will be cutting the energy flow among all of us. Also, make sure that you keep your feet uncrossed for the same reason. I quietly obeyed her. Across from me, a young Santera, whom I knew to be a daughter of Yemaya, tensed her body and began the laborious breathing that precedes the manifestation. My heart started to beat faster inside my chest. For some wild moments, I thought of getting up from the table and leaving the seance, but knowing that such an action would result in disagreeable psychic after effects, I remained seated at my madrina's side. The Santera's labored breathing grew until she was making a hideous rasping sound in her throat, similar to the death rattle, which is usually how ancestors manifest. They start from the moment of death and then they come back. So I leaned over toward my madrina and asked her if I could get up to get a glass of water. I was not thirsty. I was simply looking for an excuse to leave the table. My madrina shook her head in silence and motioned me to stay put. One of the other persons at the table was an elderly man who had been a Santero for 30 years. He started interrogating the daughter of Yemaya, who continued breathing with difficulty. What's the spirit's problem, he wanted to know. Was there anything we could do for it, or was there anyone in the room for whom it had a message? All of his questions went unanswered. Finally, my madrina stood and opened the bottle of rum I had bought. Taking a large mouthful of the fiery liquid, she sprayed the face of the possessed Santera. The woman trembled violently and tensed her body even more. Again, my madrina sprayed rum all over the Santera's face. This time, the woman's reaction was more definite. She stood up clumsily, pushing her chair backward until it turned over with a loud thud. Quite unexpectedly, she extended her hands in my direction and said, "Give me your hands." I looked at my madrina helplessly, but she motioned me to obey the Santera. I looked up slowly and extended my hands to the Ialocha. The woman's eyes had been closed. Now they opened and stared at me with a hypnotic intensity. Her hands closed like a vice around mine, and I immediately felt an electrical charge had been passed through my fingers to the top of my head. I began to tremble violently, my teeth chattering audibly. "Do you know who I am?" asked the spirit possessing the Santera. I shook my head in silence, unable to speak. "I am your great-grandmother, Sonia," said the spirit, still fixing me with her terrible, unblinking eyes. "Was one of your grandmothers named Tonya?" I asked my madrina in a low voice. I nodded, still silent. "Then the possession is genuine," said my madrina. "Listen to what she tells you." The Santera's hands continued to press mine until I felt sure that all the bones in my fingers would be crushed. Her breathing slowly relaxed as the possession became complete, but still she made the rasping sound deep within her throat. You have heard of me, haven't you?" the spirit insisted. I nodded. I had often heard my mother reminisce about her formidable grandmother who rode bareback like a man and almost single-handedly built a sugarcane and tobacco empire. "Speak to me," she ordered the spirit with authority. "Yes, I have," I said in an almost inaudible voice. "Good," said the spirit more kindly. "You never met me. I died before you were born, but I am never far from you. I watch over you all the time and make sure nothing bad happens to you." A fine mist seemed to spread over my eyes and my voice trembled slightly when I answered, "Thank you." "I know why you were afraid of the world of the spirit," my great-grandmother continued. "To you, it's the unknown, a world of shadows and fear. But to us who have crossed the barrier of light, it is not a shadowy, fearful world. It is a place of great peace and tranquility. But only," she added with a sudden frown, "if we have the understanding to know who we are and where we are. Many of us do not have such an understanding. They are confused and frightened, and they are often not aware that they are no longer in the material world. That is why candles, offerings and prayers are helpful, because they are great sources of spiritual energy that raises the vibratory levels of the downtrodden souls, awakening them to their spiritual reality. Don't be afraid of us. Pray for us and we will grow stronger. And soon we will be able to share that strength with you." "I will," I said softly. The spirit smiled and her hand softened over mine. "I want to give you a present," she said suddenly. She reached out a hand toward the flowers I had bought and picked out a single white rose. She held the rose in her hand for a few moments, her entire arm shaking with tension. Then she relaxed her hold on the rose and extended it to me. "Keep it always," she said. I will bring you many blessings, and remember me in your prayers. Remember all of us who love you. We will wait for you until the day that you join us, and then we will all rejoice together. My great-grandmother was the only spirit that manifested that night. When I left the seance, I felt very much at peace. Upon reaching my house, I placed the rose that I received from her in a vase with water, which I put on my desk. It lasted until unchanged for 3 months. At the end of this time, note the number 3 months. At the end of this time, all of the petals fell off the stem, but they still retained their original freshness and fragrance. I gathered them lovingly in a small lavender envelope, which I always carry with me. The petals are now withered, but the smell of fresh roses can still be perceived when I open the envelope. From this experience, I began to pray consistently to the dead in my family. I still feel a bit edgy when I come in contact with the dead, but I am no longer afraid. I believe what my grandmother told me, that what I fear is the unknown, a natural, inborn human fear. On Mondays, before turning my attentions to Alegua, I go into my bathroom and light a candle to all the dead in my family. I always place a small glass of cool water and some hot black coffee next to the candle on the floor, and I am no longer afraid to shake my palo and let my dead know that I still love them. So this is her personal story of going to deal with her ancestors and her great-grandmother manifesting. Now, it is really powerful when you've had some of these experiences yourself. If you haven't, then it's something that you might be terrified of. But like her grandmother told her, we spend more time in the world of the dead than we spend in the world of the living. And our time here on this planet is very, very short. If someone lives 80 years, 80 years goes by very quickly. If you live 100 years, 100 years goes by very quickly. It's a drop in time compared to the lion's share of your life that you spent in the world of the dead before you came here and you return to when you leave here. And like I said, these people are the reason you exist. They were a living sacrifice, and through their procreation, they created descendants down to who came to be you. Now, I think I've talked about this once before, but I'll say it again here because it's appropriate. The difference between Set and Asar, or also known as Set, Typhon, and Osiris, to those who are more familiar with the Greek renditions, Set wanted to live forever. So he was impotent, meaning he couldn't have any children, but his form lasted forever. So there's no need to have children if you live forever. If I live forever, why would I need to procreate? There's no need to, because I exist forever. Asar, on the other hand, decided to live forever via death and resurrection through his progeny. So in other words, he understood that as long as there's a genetic copy of me on the planet in the form of my son, who we know as Heru now, then I'm never really dead. As long as my son is alive and he has children and they have children, then I'm not really gone. Because in quite a few, if not most African traditions, ancestors are nothing but, newborn babies are nothing but ancestors who are reborn. So in other words, in a past life, your mother might have been your sister. And in the life that you're in currently, your mother is your mother. Or she could have been your brother. Sex doesn't matter. It's the genetics that mean everything. If anyone ever read a book called Of Water and Spirit by Maladoma Somme, you'll understand that very intimately, because Maladoma Somme was one of the most extremely important and powerful ancestors of the Dagara people that came back in the form of him. And he discusses that so powerfully. It's one of my favorite books that I tell people to read if they want to get a deep understanding of the beauty and the richness of traditional African spirituality, and especially ancestral reverence and how that works and how incredibly powerful it is. This book that I just read from the Santeria Experience is another one that also goes into that. That's why I went through those little excerpts, because they're really, really powerful at conveying that information. Now, there's an article that I had that I printed years ago, and I can't even find this article anymore. So I'm glad that I printed it. It is entitled, What are the Shepsu? And Shepsu is the Kemetic term for ancestors. Sheps S-C-H-E-P-S is singular, Shepsu, or anything with the U at the end is plural. So you have Neter or Neter, because it's really a rolling R, which is singular, and Neteru, which is plural. So Shepsu are ancestors. Sheps is an ancestor. So it says, what are the Shepsu? Thousands of years ago BC, there existed in what is presently called the continent of Africa, a group of people that set the tone for the rest of the Kemetic or ancient Egyptian nation. I implore you to take a deeper look at the legend of Asar and Aset, because it is really the true history of the people placed in allegorical terms. But let's continue. Thousands of years ago, there existed enlightened souls that sought to share their enlightenment with their neighboring brothers and sisters. They had observed and studied the natural surroundings around them so much that they were inspired to change their lives for the better. These illustrious beings in their lifetime, along with the Neteru, established customs, laws, rituals, and techniques that they had intuited or learned from Neter, a.k.a. nature. That's where the word nature comes from, is the Egyptian term Neter. It is with these new standards that they began to shape and mold what was once tribal nations into one powerful nation and society called Kemet. It was through them enlightenment that inspired not only a rich culture and spiritual system, but civilization. It is these individuals who we call Shepsu, or enlightened African ancestors, because it was through their undying efforts that they improved the lives of their family, people, nation, and the world. Now, a Sheps didn't have to live in Kemet in order to be one. A Sheps could be any person that is passed on into the next life, but while on earth made a strong mark or great contribution to your familial line, their bloodline, and it helped to shape how you live and view the world for the better. There are some deceased relatives that made a mark on the planet also, and it stinks, but we'll talk about them later. Those are called dark deceased. Why didn't the Kemetic people change their ways, is a question they ask. Now, Westerners marvel over the architectural structures and the colossal sculptures. They enjoy finding and displaying the fine jewelry made with its inlaid gold and precious stones of our people, but have always failed to understand one thing. They studied the Greek and Roman histories and observed their architecture, arts, and crafts, and noticed that their quote-unquote own ancestors took pride in being who they were. Basically, the Greeks and Romans enjoyed making those things to adorn their bodies and themselves. They invented so-called romanticism and different artistic styles, but the Kemetic people continued to do what they called the same old wall painting, sculptures, and have a glyph or hieroglyphics pictorial writing system, even though they had written script language and continued to display their divinities with the heads of animals. They Westerners never understood why the Kemetic people never changed their ways, because they never dealt seriously and understood the importance of a traditional practice known throughout the world as ancestral homage. This becomes obvious when you understand that the people were ancient Africans, and the reason they never changed their style was because it was not in alignment with the ancestral code or laws. If you loved your mother and father, would you offend them by doing what you wanted to do instead of following the laws that they put down? Well, don't answer that question, but the Kemetic people wouldn't do it, and most traditional people wouldn't either. This is why one of the greatest crimes in the Kemetic culture was to disrespect the Shepsu and those who have spoken on their behalf. No king or queen would dare want to cross over into the spiritual realm with such a great stain on their soul. Imagine the most honored person you knew and respected seeing you act like a fool, and you tell them that you were doing whatever you wanted to do. That is a heavy, heavy burden, and no one would want to have that type of energy on their shoulders. It is for this reason, in the ancient traditional society, not only in Africa, but in China and even Japan, it was better to die honorably than just to die. It is the Shepsu who established the laws and codes necessary for one to be honored. In Kemet and other places where ancestral homage continued, it was taken literal before the biblical writer inscribed it on tablets to honor your father and mother, But to do that effectively, you must not only honor your present parents, but their parents also. So basically, you're getting an understanding of why there was a consistent practice throughout Kemetic culture and history. And as you start to study, you'll find, if you study Kemet in particular, that any time that they veered away from the original ancestral way, they ended up being invaded by another group of people. And what you'll also find is every time that they were invaded by another group of people, It was usually the Nubians, the original Egyptians, who settled that region tens of thousands of years before, who would come from the south, kick out the invaders, and reestablish the old ways. And every time they established the old ways, Kemet would prosper. Every time they veered away from the old ways, Kemet would fall. So there's a consistent historical narrative in Kemet itself that shows that as they adopted more outside cultural norms, which also got rid of ancestral reverence because a lot of these people who invaded practiced racism on them. These were white people or Middle Easterners, and they would come in, suppress the native black people, which is why if you go to Kemet today, you'll find that all over the north area, from Cairo all the way up to Luxor, you find Persians, descendants of Persians, Greeks with a little bit of African admixture, Arabs, and all of these people. And then once you get to Luxor and you move further south, everybody's black. Because what they did was, as they invaded Kemet in different times, and Sheikh Antijolt talks about it, Dr. Gary Greenberg has talked about it, Mustafa Gadala's talked about it, Dr. Ben has talked about it. What it is that as they were invaded, the blacks who did not want to stay and mix with the invaders would go south into Nubia, or they would go west or into Central Africa. So that's why you'll find that there's people across the continent, different ethnic groups, that still speak and write in Medunetta to this day. It's just not shown to the public. So we're talking about the Yoruba people. There's a great book written by a man named J. Olumides Lucas called The Religion of the Yoruba in Relation to the Religion of Ancient Egypt, where he shows you the linguistics, that the Yoruba language of Nigeria is a direct descendant of the Medunetta language. He shows you that. He talks about the different spiritual practices, the food practices, the priesthood. He breaks it all down and shows that it's intimately Nile Valley African civilization that relocated to West Africa, and the Yoruba themselves tell in their own history that they came from the East, and they're the ones who actually absorbed the Nok people. The Nok culture is the oldest culture in West Africa, oldest complete culture in West Africa. And it was the Yoruba people who they say came with Oduduwa from the Nile Valley when Egypt was invaded and settled what we now call Nigeria.
Hey.
Same thing with the Wolof of Senegal. Go ahead.
I got, we didn't have no questions tonight, and I have a lot to put in on this particular subject, but I'm not comfortable doing it publicly, so appreciate you for explaining this in great detail, but I do have a question, and that is... For those of us who were raised... me being Southern Baptist, was taught to stay clean away from all of that. But then me and you was having a private conversation, and you were showing me where a lot of the people in the Bible was practicing these same practices. Can you go into that? Because we are getting a little short on time. I'd like for you to explain that a little bit before we go off.
No problem. Okay. So when you look at ancestral reverence, the only people whose ancestral reverence practices are demonized are black people. I repeat that. When you look in at ancestral homage or ancestral reverence, the only people whose ancestral reverence practices are demonized are black people. When you take a dollar out your pocket and you see George Washington's face, or any of the other dollar bills with Lincoln and whoever else you can name, that's ancestral reverence. When you walk down the street and your street is called Washington Avenue, or it's called Lincoln Place, or any of the other names of presidents, that's ancestral reverence. And every time you say their name, you perpetuate their life force and their energy in today's world. Because in African culture, to say an ancestor's name is to give them life. So even though they're physically not here, they gather strength from the fact that you still remember them. One of the worst things that can happen to you in Nile Valley culture and in many, many traditional African societies was for you to be forgotten and for no one to ever say your name. So you say their names every time you go to the streets you walk down or you live on, when you take the dollar bill out your pocket, but yet that form of practice was completely annihilated or attempted to be completely annihilated amongst the Africans they brought here in enslavement, as well as with the Native Americans who were already here and other groups that were non-white. And Black people were told, you know, you're not supposed to do this stuff, and they were killing people for doing it. So you find that the actual white people that we live amongst practice ancestral reverence all the time. They just don't like when you do it because there's power in it. And I would actually say that is one of the main ways they've maintained the power that they've maintained for so long, is that they've continued to pay homage to the most terroristic, evil, and vile people that ever walked the planet. And those ancestors respond in kind by helping them be successful at dominating us. Now, when you look in the Bible, they say that the Bible is the unmitigated, unadulterated word of God. But yet, each one of the books in the Bible is named after a human being. And when you say those names, you're practicing ancestral reverence in a non-codified way. First Samuel this, Paul that, the Thessalonians this, the Corinthians that, the Ephesians this. You're saying names of people who once existed, and in some cases, the names of the human beings who wrote specific books in the Bible that people now say is the inspired word of the Creator. They talk about, now a lot of people don't know this, but gambling has its foundation in oracles. The original 52 playing cards in the deck of cards were actually originally an oracle that eventually became the tarot. Rolling dice was an oracle. In the Bible, they call it casting lots. And you can read about casting lots. You can actually put that in Google. Just put casting lots in the Bible, and you'll bring up the verses that directly relate to that. Whenever the Israelites wanted to find out whether or not a particular day was auspicious for them to go to war, they would consult the oracle by casting lots. And the oracle of the Israelites could only give a yes or no answer. So if they said, okay, on June 6th, we want to go and attack the Philistines, is this an auspicious day to do this? They would cast lots, and the oracle would either say, yes, it is, or it'll say, no, it's not. And based on the answer they got, they would either go to war on that day or they would wait until it was auspicious for them to go to war. So they practice it right in the Bible. They put it right there. They just call it in these weird clandestine names so that you can't pull it out and say, oh, wow. But why do they, why, well, my ancestors told that this stuff was negative or evil or whatever the case may be, when actually the people who dominate us and the people who this book is associated with did the same thing. So you'll find all throughout the Bible these clandestine ways of doing the very thing that Black people were demonized for doing and killed for doing. The difference is it's masked under the cover of religiosity, and it's okay for those people who practice that particular religion, i.e. Christianity, it's fine for them, and especially because they don't hone in on it and call it what it really is. And then when you hear an African person say, hey, I practice, you know, voodoo, they'll be looked at in a negative light for that reason. And the truth is, that very system was the system that gave the Haitian people the impetus to liberate themselves. They continued to practice the voodoo religion. They consulted their ancestors before going to war, during war, and after war. And they did what they knew they had to do to free themselves. And as a result, they've been suffering for the last couple hundred years, paying reparations to the French for liberating themselves.
Hey, on
that's how dangerous revering your ancestors is in a system of white supremacy. Go ahead, Jenna. I'm sorry.
No, we have a call. Miss Sharon, I believe. How are you doing this evening?
Oh, yeah.
I'm doing well, brothers. How are you?
Still learning.
Good, good. How are you? Good to hear
okay.
from you.
Okay. I joined the community.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes, I did. Brother Jenna.
Oh, beautiful.
I can understand that you weren't brought up that way, but Brother Ross is correct. I don't know as much as he does, but I have been around some of those things since I was a child. And I don't fear it. Some, you know, people and some children may fear it, but I never did for some reason. But what he's saying is on the money. My colleagues had gotten used to me over the years, and my family, if we go to a wake of someone, even a friend, a close friend, we wear white. We were never taught to wear black. And, yeah. You know, the fragrance of flowers, that's very true. When my mother passed, I had to run an errand. And I jumped in my car to run an errand because, you know, you have a lot of things to do in preparation. Right. And I turned around and looked at my back seat. No one else was in my vehicle but me. All I could smell was flowers. Well, my mother loved flowers and she loved perfume. It was so powerful and strong. I had to stop the car and keep turning around. And then I acknowledged her. You know, and there's other things I won't tell you, you know, tonight, but it is real. And people have been taught that it's evil and it's wrong, but it can also be a blessing, you know, to just bury, you know, your loved ones and think that that's it. And everything Brother Roz is saying, you know, I can identify with, and it resonates with me. And it was very touching for me, Brother Roz, because I've grown up seeing this, hearing it, experiencing it, and being taught a lot of it. And it just touched my heart and just brought back memories. So I just wanted to encourage Brother Jenna. So that's all I want to keep
wonderful.
You guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes.
And, wow.
I'm
anytime.
Sure there's so many more people out there that feel the same
go ahead.
Way. Nah, you go ahead, Miss Sharon. I was just saying thank you.
I just wanted to really encourage you. And, you know, you don't know me per se, but, you know, the way we have been trained and taught. And then think of this. Oh, also, water. I can't remember from my grandmother, but water has a very powerful significance to the ancestors, even a glass of water. But, you know, if you can think back and look at what the advertisers have done to people, you grew up thinking Casper or a ghost always had white on. So you see how they play with your mind. You know, my family, we always, on my dad's side, we always wore white for our loved ones when we put them away. But just think of that, how they've tricked us with that. And there's many things that Brother Ross touched on that I could identify with how they flipped it to make it, you know, twisted. But they're using our culture and our knowledge.
Absolutely.
So, but Casper and any horror film, whatever, I used to look at that as a kid. And, you know, my dad would tell me, you know, you see what they're doing. You know white is not bad for us to say goodbye to our loved ones. So, like I said, I just wanted to encourage you both.
Oh, so, you
guys,
you
know, brothers,
I greatly appreciate you.
You have a very good night. The information, you know, as I said, it was, you know, really good for me. But you would know better, Brother Ross. But, yes, water has definitely a significance. But, you know, I was like 10 when my grandmother died. So a lot of things are still strong in my memory. But I do know water. It's not just the ocean. And something else, the video you had on North Carolina, they mentioned the shores of North Carolina. That's where my dad is from. That's where he was born. That's where my grandmother had to wind up being settled from her parents being slaves. So, but yes, water, you know, a glass of water.
I'm
going to
talk about that briefly. Yeah, I'm going to talk about that briefly. It's interesting because, thank you, sister. And I appreciate it. I don't know did you have anything else to add before I go into that?
No. I just wanted to, you know, just contribute that to let you know. It's just so marvelous. It's the ancestors. It's so good. But I've had a lot of experiences all my life. As I said, I never feared, but the things you're saying are very true. they will come to you. It's just, you know what I'm talking about, but no, we can't just share this, you know, now, but it is, it's very true, and it's very powerful. And as I said, a lot of people don't understand. They have done themselves a lot of disservice because of the wrong teaching of what it means for us to, you know, lose our ancestors. And we don't really lose them. And you have to, something else, you know, scientifically, physical science, you know, water carries its own charge within itself. So it's things that you resonated. You made my memory banks just start returning, and also, you know, painful, not painful memories, but, you know, just missing. And hey, I'm human. We're all human still. But I still have a very good feeling, because I don't, you know, have that same idea that has been indoctrinated into our people about death and our, and not their lack of knowledge about their ancestors, you know. So therefore, it's all, it's very good, you know. Most, every day I wake up with a good feeling, because I'm constantly identifying with them, in communication with them, trying to walk that should walk. And so that's all I wanted, you know, to add.
I greatly appreciate you, and I greatly appreciate your contribution. I am ecstatic that you're part of the community, so you'll see me there. And I look forward to, yeah, I look forward to, you know, chopping it up with you on there too. And I'm right now, I'm just going to pick up on it, because you just dropped some really, really stuff, and I wanted to,
okay,
to speak on
good.
It.
Okay, good. Yeah, no, I want to hear it. All right, have a good
cool.
night, brothers. Okay,
you
thank
you. You can
just
mute yourself. You don't have to hang up. You can mute yourself, and that's fine if you want to. You don't have to hang up.
Okay, no, go ahead and proceed. I'll hang up. It's
okay, no problem.
No,
you don't have to hang up, Miss Cher.
Okay, Brother Jenner.
Peace and love, sister. Much love to you. And so this is interesting, because when you go to most Christian funerals, right, you'll have, because in Islam, they actually wear white. I had a cousin that was murdered years ago. And I remember that his funeral was the first Islamic funeral I'd ever gone to. And it was one of the most simplistic and beautiful ceremonies I'd ever seen. And I remember they had his entire body covered in a white shroud. They had him in a simple pine box cast, pine casket. And I remember they put handfuls of soil at the head of the casket, and a handful of soil at the foot of the casket. And they went through this entire really eloquently beautiful ritual. And most people were wearing black, but us as his family, some of us wore white. And the normal practice at funerals is to wear black. Most people don't know where that comes from. Where that comes from is the deity known as Anubis, which is the equivalent in Kemet of Eshu. He's the road opener deity, and he's the deity who actually leads the dead into the Hall of Judgment, where the scale is measured, their heart is measured against the feather of Ma'at on Ma'at scales of justice. And once the verdict is read, if the scales are balanced, then that person goes into Amenta, which the Greeks used to call the Elysian Field. If the heart is heavier than the feather of Ma'at, then that specific soul is sent to what's known as Amit, the devourer. And Amit is like a composite deity of three different animals, part lion, part crocodile, and part hippopotamus, and it eats and devours the soul of that person whose heart isn't as light as the feather of Ma'at, meaning that you're carrying dead weight and regrets from the life that you led before you came to the world of the dead. And that black deity is where the wearing of colored black at the funerals in America comes from. Also, that is where the color black that you see the judge wear in the courtroom comes from. They are symbolically dunning the black skin of Anubis and his role as the guide and judge of the dead. Now, it's interesting, because my father-in-law passed away at 88 years old, and he was a very, very intense Christian man who used to go to church like every Sunday, was really into it, a big part of the church, him and his wife. He would take my son. I remember my son was wearing these three-piece suits when he was a child, and they would take him everywhere. And a couple years before he passed away, and I remember when I came back from Egypt, my family and I, It's like the trajectory of our family moved in the most African-centered direction. It was already in that direction before we went to Kemet, but afterwards, once, you know, my wife and son were able to convey what I and Dr. Renoko Rashidi taught them and showed them on the walls of Kemet, the origins of Christianity, where you could see, you know, the Annunciation, the virgin birth, everything on the temples of Kemet. It just shifted the trajectory of the family. And a couple of years before he passed away, as he was getting sicker and he was still in his right mind, we had a conversation about how he wanted to go home when he passed away. And he told us he wanted to wear white. He wanted every one of us to wear white at his funeral, which was the complete antithesis of what he wanted prior to this time frame, as far as we understood. And weirdly enough, an extremely close friend of mine, he's from the Garune people of northeastern Ghana. These people are known as the people of the Tekken, because until this day, they still erect obelisks. When people pass away and become ancestors, they erect an obelisk in their honor. And people will come to that obelisk and pay homage and leave gifts and say prayers for that deceased person at that shrine, which is actually an entire obelisk. And he came to the ceremony, and we did a traditional African ceremony at my father-in-law's funeral that was just incredibly powerful. And the interesting part about it is that what the sister Sharon was talking about with water. I suggest everybody read a book. It's called The Power of Water by a Japanese scientist named Emoto. And what he did was he took different containers of water, glasses of water, and he would say and write certain words. So he'll say hate, or he'll say love, and he'll actually write that and put the label on the bottle of water and then put it in the freezer to freeze. And anytime he put something negative, the crystals were really in disarray, and the ice crystals would be in disarray and very, very disorganized, almost in a state of chaos. But any of the containers he labeled with something positive, like love or self-affirming things, each of the crystals were clearly defined with these beautiful, it was like a tapestry of snowflakes. You know how each snowflake is individual and it has a certain number of crystals and a certain number of angles to it? It would be like just beautiful to look at under a microscope. And it's called the power of water because water actually holds and absorbs energy of the person or thing that is touching it or is in contact with it. So if you're in a negative state, the water is in a negative state. If you're in a positive state, the water is in a positive state. And he proved this scientifically. That's why I want people to read the book. Now, the importance of water as far as the African traditional system is concerned is that water is the secret keeper. Everything that you do in the ocean falls to the ocean floor and is usually never retrieved. So our ancestors that were tossed overboard, eventually their bodies decayed, fell to the bottom of the ocean, and the ocean itself kept the secrets of their existence. And the realm of water itself is considered an important aspect of the ancestral realm. In Kemet specifically, the crocodile, known as Sebek, is very close to the ancestors. And he's also known as a god of the dead. Even the turtle, which they call Sheta or Shetu, which is the plural for the term turtle in the Medunetter. Turtles were also gods of the dead. They had an ambiguous nature, but they were specifically gods of the dead who people could ask for their intercession in helping them make their way and navigate through the world of the dead when they get there. And water itself is a medium through which, like I talked about, there's a Kemetic proverb that each person is like the deity, the all, is considered an ocean of consciousness, and each person is an individual drop that comes out of the ocean of the creator's consciousness. So the same way that a drop of water has the same properties and the same qualities as the ocean does, but on a smaller scale, the human being does, as far as the deity is concerned, have the same abilities and properties as the deity, but on a smaller scale. So that is a direct connection between the existence of humans and our ancestors and water itself as an element. And it's a funny thing, because when my wife had gone to a ceremony. One of her best friends had lost his sister. I'm about to wrap it up in 1 second, and I just want to tell the story before we do it. She had gone to one of her best friends, her best friend's sister. His sister passed away, and he wanted my wife to sing at the funeral. And she went. I wasn't with her at the time. This was not too long before we actually met each other. And she went to it. It was a Jamaican funeral. Brother Cujo probably would be familiar with this possibly. And at the funeral, she sang and everything, and everybody came together after the funeral, and they were eating food and stuff, and they went to her old apartment, and they had something known as what's called a nine night. Now, a nine night is pretty much they wait, and it could be up to 9 days for a sign from the spirit that it has transitioned to the other side and it is okay. And one of the things that they'll do is they'll wait for a physical sign or manifestation from the dead to be that that bell ringer to let you know that they've transitioned and that they're okay where they are. And she said she was there. Everybody was, you know, together. They were praying. They were talking, having conversations, and everybody was reminiscing about his sister. And at one point, I think it was around 3 o'clock in the morning, if I remember correctly what she said, that there was a picture of her that nobody touched, nobody was near it, but it was knocked off the wall onto the floor. And that was the sign everybody was waiting for from his sister before everybody broke away to go about, you know, their business and close out the night and eventually go on with their lives after the funeral was done. And this is something, these practices are things that still remain in many Caribbean countries, depending on the people involved and whether or not they still practice these traditions, but they're still there. They're dying out depending on whether or not these things are passed on to different people. So that was just a personal tidbit again about just the ancestors and their importance and the fact that even though they're not physically here, there are many different ways that they make themselves manifest to their descendants and to people who care about them. And we'll discuss this a little further. I know we're at the end of the show, so I'm going to get ready to wrap it up. But I wanted to definitely just throw that out there after talking to Sister Sharon and Jenna chimed in. It was just some things I needed to get off my chest when we closed out. So I would just like to, Jenna, I don't know if you had anything else you wanted to say before, you know, we say the prayer and close out. Just let me know. And then from there, we'll move forward.
Nah, you go ahead. We just, whoa.
Okay. Now, okay, no problem. Now, it's funny because the number of the ancestors in the Yoruba tradition is the number 9. And the deity that's most closely associated with the ancestors is known as Oya. She was one of the wives of Shango, and she is the god of the dead. Now, in Kemet, she's known as Nekabet, which is a deity that's represented by the vulture, and vultures guide the dead as well in Kemetic tradition. So there's all these ties between these different ethnic groups. Just wanted to put that out there, too. So now we're going to get ready to close out the show, but this will continue. We'll continue this conversation down the road. But I just wanted to thank everyone for spending a Tuesday evening with us. This is the 4th of June, 2019. We greatly appreciate each and every one of you. We thank you all. Thanks to Sister Sharon for chiming in. Greatly appreciate your insight and your wisdom and your information. Peace and greetings to all the other calls and listeners and those who didn't chime in. Also to those who will listen to the podcast. We greatly appreciate each and every one of you. And we're going to get ready to close out the show right now. So I'll say the prayer and we'll wrap it up. Again, thanks to everyone. Creator, we ask that you help us to remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us to remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times and all places. Each and every time that we are in contact with another Black person, it has been time. Let's replace white supremacy with justice ASAP, and let's end human trafficking as well as the prison industrial complex as soon as possible. I am in the love of the all, and all love is in me. I am a part of the all, and the all is a part of me. I am one with the all, and the all is one with me. I can succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. I can be all that I wish in the all, as long as my wish is to stay in the all. I am never alone. The all is, I am. The all can, I can. The all does, I do. And remember the African proverb, if there are no enemies within, enemies without can do very little harm. Thanks again. Peace and love to each and every one of you. Stay safe. May your ancestors surround you empowerment and protection, keep you safe, and help you to make all of the correct steps in your life to get the things that you need to attain in this lifetime before you become an ancestor yourself. I wish that for each and every one of the listeners here. Thanks once again. Peace and love. Maximum respect to each and every one of you, and we'll see you again next Tuesday, Creator willing. Peace.
Peace and love. Thanks, Roz, for introducing us to that. Thanks to all the callers and listeners, and we will see y'all next week. Be on the lookout for our little pop-ups, too.
Absolutely. One love to everybody. Stay safe. Stay out of the hands of those slave catchers. Please think before you speak. Think before you act. Ask your ancestors to intercede with anything that you need help with, whether it's a health issue, whether it's a financial issue, if it's a relationship problem. Talk to them and speak to them like you speak to another person. Just be respectful and honor them, and make sure that you always say their name. That's most important. Never forget their name. And if you don't know their name, you just say, hey, to those ancestors whose names I know, as well as those I don't know. That's a great way of putting it, where you'll still be able to acknowledge them and help them elevate. Thanks again. Peace and love, and we'll see you next Tuesday. One love.
Immortality, I alter my physical chemistry. Bop through the valley of the shadow of death. I exist even when no things are left. Vibrations transcend space and time. Pure at heart because I deal with the mind. That's why I compose these verses. Lord of all worlds, my thoughts are now universes. Written on these pages is the ageless wisdom of the sages. Ignorance is